Good morning again, everybody. My name is Carlos Bachon. You are on this webinar on U.S. and EU perspectives on wheat and sustainable remediation. I am with the U.S. EPA, and this webinar, particular webinar, has been organized in collaboration with Dietmar Mueller of the Austria Environment Agency. And we'll hear a little bit more about the background on this webinar and other related events in just a minute. So for those of you that are actually on the website, please go to slide number 2, and we need to do a little bit of housekeeping before we actually get started. Many of you have been on these webinars before. If you have not, or as a refresher, please remember to mute your phones so that we have a clear and crisp discussion with only the speaker being heard. If you are on a cell phone or your phone does not have a mute button, you can press star 6 to mute your phone, star 6. And then to unmute, if you need to speak, you can press pound 6. For those of you on the internet, we will have question and answer sessions, and we hope to have this other discussion toward the end. We have reserved some time for that purpose. If you have a question you'd like to ask at any point, you can click on the question mark button. As you see on your screen, you have a series of orange and blue buttons. The question mark button opens up a little chat box where you can send you can type in your question. I will be moderating those questions as they come in, and you can ask them at any time. In fact, anybody on the webinar can use that button at any time. If you are on a conference line, of course, when we have the Q&A question session, you are free to ask a question verbally when prompted. So that's what I wanted to do for housekeeping. Now let's please move on to slide number 3. So this is the seminar that is a continuation of a series of seminars on this topic that we have had over the last 3 years now. It's part 4, as we'll see in a second, and the title is U.S. and EU Perspectives on Green and Sustainable Remediation. To go over the agenda, let's toggle over to the next slide. Slide number 4. So this is the agenda for today. Again, my name is Carlos Patron. I'm with the U.S. EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. I will be the moderator for this webinar, and I will also be giving a short presentation on current activities in the U.S. EPA. The first speaker after my introductions will be Andrea Benner, who is joining us from EPA's Region 9 office in San Francisco, out on the West Coast in the U.S., so it's very early for her. Thank you for joining us, Andrea. The second speaker will be Jan Vimek, who is joining us from Prague and will be giving the second presentation. After that, we'll be hearing from Austria EPA. Jano Drobel will be giving a presentation on Austria's new NCEA tool. After that, I will be giving some updates on developments here in the U.S. EPA related to greener cleanups. And then Paul Bartos will be joining us from the U.K. to provide you all with updates on international initiatives of several activities that we have been tracking on these webinars. Thank you for pulling that information together, Paul. I look forward to hearing the updates. And finally, Dietmar Mueller will be presenting the second International Conference on Sustainable Remediation, which is scheduled to be held in Vienna in the fall of this year. And after that, we'll open it up for discussion. Any questions that we didn't have time to answer, we will open up for discussion at that point. And we look forward to your active participation in that part. Okay, let's go to slide number 5, please. A quick note on slide numbers. If you are joining us on quote-unquote paper only with a conference line, please note that we need to change some material. So the slides numbering has changed a little bit. We will be going off of the slide numbers on the screen on the website. If you download the PowerPoint now or the PDF, you will also get the correct numbering. So please be aware that there has been a change. And if you downloaded the material before yesterday, before today, you may have to make some adjustments. So we are currently on slide 5. And I wanted to provide a little bit of a background of how we came to where we are now, why this is webinar number 4. In the past, everything was quite recent, but we realized that some of it is starting to be quote-unquote history. We started on this topic, these conversations of U.S. and EU perspectives on green sustainable remediation started at CONSOL 2008. In Milan, it was held in Milan, and it was actually a sustainable remediation track. And as part of the EPA series of presentations, it was also an introduction to the concepts of green remediation. By the way, that that conference, EPA's participation, was broadcast by webinar. And if you're interested in seeing where we were back then, you can do so through the resources page. Early on in these conversations, we found that while there was quite a bit of common ground on technical aspects of building sustainability into site cleanups, there were different perspectives on how to advance on the policy front. After CONSOL, a meeting was scheduled by the Danish EPA with several sponsoring organizations in Copenhagen. It was really the first international forum on the specific topic of green remediation. They had a program that was already structured around pretty much the series of topics where we are now. There was a policy front. There was a discussion on decision support tools or the practice of measuring footprints and sustainability. And then there was a technology front as well. But early in the thinking on this topic, and at that time, we did speak specifically of sustainable technologies for site cleanup. That thinking has changed, has matured, at least here in EPA, and now we think from the broader topic of building sustainability into site cleanup, regardless of what technology is used. Several people active in this area at that time started speaking and exploring ideas of collaborating to exchange knowledge, experiences, etc., and an agreement was reached to work together to have content in the CONSOL 2010 meeting, 2 years after the first discussions. At that meeting, there were several presentation themes on footprint assessment, on low footprint technologies, and on the national policies for sustainable contaminated site management. There was also a special session on sustainable remediation. In preparing for CONSOL, we agreed that we ourselves had an opportunity to reduce the footprint of this technical collaboration, and we agreed that a lot of the concepts could be advanced through webinars, in addition to the in-person speaking, networking opportunities that were provided at CONSOL and other similar events. So we had a pre-con soil webinar that got us all prepared for the actual event. That was in July of 2010, and it set the groundwork for con soil 2010. We had a follow-up webinar after con soil, comparing and contrasting perspectives on green and sustainable remediation. That was a very interesting webinar. Followed by one in October of last year, which was case parties, case studies part one. And now we're wrapping up some of those case studies with one from the U.S. and one from Europe. And we're also providing some updates on some of the current activities are. On slide number five, you'll see I put the URL where you can find all this material. We pulled it all together for the purpose of this event. It's cluin.org/global. So all the events that I've talked about are presented and summarized there. So with that, and to stay on schedule, I will hand the mic over to my colleague in California in EPA Region 9, Andrea Benner, who is a remedial project manager, and this is a topic she presented at the last meeting of the National Association of Remedial Project Managers. These are EPA Superfund project managers, and she will be speaking of her experiences at the Apache Powder Superfund site. So, Andrea?
Hello, good morning. I'm on slide six and moving to slide seven. I'm going to, this morning, give you an overview of this particular project and then discuss in more detail a renewable energy evaluation that we did to look at whether solar power would be feasible at this site location. And then I'm going to discuss some of the applications of solar and some other technologies we use to be more efficient and sustainable at this project, and then some lessons learned. I'm now on slide eight. This particular project is located in the southwest United States, very arid desert environment southeast of Tucson, Arizona. If you've seen a map, the facility is 1,100 acres, so it occupies 9 square miles, so it's quite a large area. If you move to slide nine, the purpose of this facility was established in 1922. They've been manufacturing explosives and primarily ammonium nitrate in recent years. They provide the explosive material for the mines that are in the Pacific Southwest, Arizona, Nevada, as well as Mexico. And because of their past practices, they were listed on EPA's Superfund site in 1990, so it's now 2012. We've been overseeing the cleanup at this site for more than 20 years. If you move to slide 10, that gives you some sense of sort of the dry, arid environment. The picture is looking towards the facility, the more modern part of the facility. They're very old areas of this property where they were making nitric, just very old, TNT, DNT, various explosives products in prior years. If you move to slide 11, two problems occurred with this site. One, there was quite a bit of soils contamination, and I'm not going to discuss the cleanup of that, but on the groundwater side of this project, there was major groundwater contamination of nitrate and perchlorate. And for the nitrate contaminated groundwater, we chose to use constructed wetlands, which were less energy demanding. We basically constructed, and in this case it was the company itself paid for it, 4.5 acres were designated for these five wetlands ponds that you can see in the upper right photo. And then we, the entire acreage is in a very remote locale where quite a number of areas have no electrical lines or no electrical capability. So in this area, we were able to use solar panels down in the right corner to circulate water between these ponds when the ponds were first set up for cleaning up the groundwater. If you move to slide 12, I'm going to walk through briefly, just give you a snapshot overview of the renewable energy evaluation process we went through to look at whether more large-scale solar might be feasible for the site. And I'm going to walk through how we did this study. Slide 13 gives you sort of an overview of what the pictures really give you, just a sense of this very dry, desert-like environment that the site is located on. And first we looked at the energy context for the facility itself, and we looked at what their current electrical demand, and they are still manufacturing ammonium nitrate. They have a daily use of 1 to 2 megawatts, peaking at about 2 megawatts per day, and they have an existing transmission lines and substations coming into the facility because they spend over $1 million a year just on their electrical bill. So they, energy demanding operation. If you move to slide 15, we divided up the study to look at whether they could use electricity on site for their own purposes or whether they could potentially generate more electricity and sell it back to the grid, basically generate it as a method to offset their own costs. If you move to slide 16, it gives you sort of a little closer look at the facility acreage. That irregular shaped outline is the 1,100 acres. It's what's called Badlands topography. It has a lot of hills, small hills, arroyos, some inappropriate terrain for looking at renewable energy in terms of solar. So we basically, the green areas identify the areas where the slope was less than 5% and it looked reasonably feasible potentially for solar. The slide 17 and 18, we basically narrowed the solar evaluation to looking at concentrated solar power, CFP versus trough technology versus photovoltaic, which is slide 18. And basically, if you go to slide 19, in looking at the topography, looking at the amount of water that would be needed for concentrating solar power, it was so significant, and this southwest U.S. is prone to drought, prone to water conservation is extremely important in this part of the United States. So we ended up at this point moving towards more closely looking primarily at photovoltaic. If you move to slide 20, you can see another overview of the acreage of the site and how we divided up where to make that decision to go and look more closely at photovoltaic. We zoned various parts of the facility to see what where we could find what amount of acreage and then compared what might be most feasible in one or the other locations. Slide 21 is and look at a more in-depth look at the photovoltaic opportunities, looking at thin film fixed access versus crystalline silicon versus PV. basically looking at fixed access versus tracking, and what the acreage requirements would be, what the cost would be, what the all size for a 5-megawatt facility. Obviously, the entire study was many more analyses than what I'm presenting this morning or this afternoon for some of you, but I wanted to give you just a sense of the type of study, the type of analyses we did in the study. The next slide, 22, gives you just another look at how we were sizing what might be feasible at the site, how we decided we were going to size for a 3 or a 5-megawatt facility, and looking at the operations peak demand and baseload demand. Slide 23 gives you some of the pros and cons or the benefits and limitations of the two technologies and what might be appropriate. The environment of water demand was a key factor in screening out concentrating solar power. The other thing that we looked at and used various opportunities to educate the company about were the use of and selling of renewable energy credits and other ways that they could make money, basically, if they chose to make this long-term investment. We also used an informational brochure that we developed that was about 8 to 10 pages for the company to internally brief their managers and then their board of directors so they could give them a mechanism for explaining the project to other decision makers within the company. If you go to the next slide, 24, for a private company in the United States, which this is still an operating facility, I might explain that in our Superfund process, our cleanup process, when a major company is identified as requiring federal oversight for cleanup, we usually, those companies often are empty. There may be a company still involved, but the facility is no longer operating. This is one of the rare few that is still an operating facility. So things like tax credits, various incentives coming from the utilities, rebates, renewable energy bonds, all of these types of financial incentives were very important to the managers. So slide 24 gives you a little bit of an overview of what we presented to the company to give them a sense of the opportunities for the project. The overall history of the site is because it's off the grid, so to speak, in various areas. In other words, where we put the wetlands ponds was an area where there were no electrical transmission lines going into that area. We started using solar, and I'm now on slide 25, for different functions. We used them to circulate water between the ponds. The top photo on slide 25, we used a small photovoltaic panel to run the flow meter for measuring the discharge post-treatment. Solar was used for security gates. Because they manufacture ammonium nitrate, this is a highly secure facility. The bottom photo on slide 25 is we were extracting or pumping up groundwater in one area and putting it into evaporation ponds where it was contaminated with perchlorate, and basically using big vats or big holding tanks, open holding tanks, and pumping the water into those tanks. It's hard to see it behind the panel. But so wherever was feasible at the site, we did use solar in small applications. If you move to slide 26, most recently, the company chose to put a solar canopy over their administration buildings. This was finished in November 2010. It's a basically a 42-kilowatt canopy that not only is providing electricity for the heating and cooling system for this administration building, but has a water catchment system on the front. So they're harvesting rainwater, which is going into vessels that are buried next to the building. And then that's used for to irrigate this what's called a xeriscape or desert landscape in front of the building. The photos are right after it was installed, but now it's blossoming cacti, et cetera, in the front of this building. So this was an example of going from these very small PV panels to the next phase. In the big picture, some of those large flat areas that you can see in the earlier photos are areas that we were encouraging and have been encouraging the company to consider for installing a 3 to 5 megawatt photovoltaic system that would actually provide a fair amount of electricity or offset their electricity demand. If you move to slide 27, I'm going to just kind of run through the lessons learned from the project. Basically, we did discuss that you can have a Superfund cleanup, which often is a very complicated process, and overlay on it sustainable methods of managing either the cleanup or managing or providing offsetting electrical demand. It isn't insurmountable. It's not, one just has to do good planning in the front part of the project or during the course of the project. We concluded that photovoltaic was more feasible for the project. The cost for installing even 5 megawatt range from 25 million for photovoltaic, and then there's some variation of cost depending on what type of photovoltaic, tracking versus fixed. What we concluded was that a power purchase agreement was very important for this facility to consider moving forward, and at this point in time, there was no immediate power purchase agreement available for the company, so that has the moving to this next higher tier of generating electricity via solar is in a holding pattern. If you move to slide 28, it still is something that they're very conscious of, though, the company, and have in their planning pocket, so to speak. The other lessons learned were the importance of public and private partnerships to support these types of projects. I don't think the company would really have even seriously considered some of these ideas if the EPA hadn't, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA had not been sort of a catalyst in opening the dialogue. And other final points maybe are that these types of projects can become complex, but they are manageable. It's not something that one should shy away from just because it seems too complicated. And so with that, slide 29 is my contact information, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Let me open up. If somebody, Andrea will be able to stay with us for the whole webinar, so she will be available at the discussion, although she has to leave promptly at the end because she has to travel. If does anybody on the phone line, however, have a question for clarification, requesting a clarification rather than expanding on the topic? from Andrea. Any questions on the phone lines? Okay, well, while you think of those, I do have a question for Andrea from the internet participants. Andrea, the question is on slide 25, there are pictures of solar panels and possibly a breaker box. I do not see any fence barrier that would prohibit trespassers. Realize this is a large area, but are there possibilities for trespassers to damage the equipment, and how is that being managed?
Well, the entire facility is overseen by the U.S. United States Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, because it manufactures ammonium nitrate. So the pictures may not, the fencing's not visible, but this 1,100-acre facility has completely fenced with Serpentina, the spiral type of barbed wire around the entire perimeter fencing. The facility is also located on next to the San Pedro River, which is one of the few waterways coming up from Mexico. So there is a major problem with border migration and border patrol. I don't know if everyone on the phone line is familiar with the Mexico-U.S. issues. So whereas it may not seem very secure, it is quite secure.
Great. Thank you, Andrea. I appreciate your joining us. I also wanted to mention that one of the reasons in speaking with Andrea, we decided that her presentation was very appropriate for, you know, a final one on the U.S., from the U.S., is she covered several topics. She did discuss sustainable cleanup and green remediation best practices, as well as possible sustainable reuse considerations. We realize that those two are often closely intertwined. We also wanted to emphasize that concept of greenhouse gas management. We've moved away from the concept that only low technologies with low greenhouse gas emissions can be considered green, because we do have options out there. Managing and optimizing energy demand by any given system, using renewable energy to power that remedy, as well as, in case of necessity, purchasing renewable energy credits for any residual energy demand. So we thought this was a good example of brought many perspectives on that topic. And also wanted to emphasize some of those small-scale power systems that Andrea highlighted. We're seeing a high acceptance of those systems on EPA's on the emergency response side of the house, for example, because while the amount of energy that they generate can be relatively small, a lot of the logistics associated with powering those systems can actually have quite a significant footprint of their own. The need to connect a remote monitoring or similar system to the grid might require building a road, putting a power line out there, or supplying and servicing auxiliary power generators. So those can be quite significant footprints of their own. So it's not only logistical, but also cost and environmental benefits of those remote systems. With that said, and in order to stay on time, if you do have further questions for Andrea, we'll have a discussion at the end of the webinar. But at this point, I'd like to hand it over to Jan Vanek of Tacoma with joining us from Prague. Jan?
Okay, good morning. Jan Vanek speaking. Well, topic chosen case study is remediation of the former military airport at Žatec site in the Czech Republic. So, moving to slide 31 with site description. The premises of the former military airport are situated at the northwestern part of the Czech Republic, and the site belonged to typical brownfields. Presently, this area is being transformed into an industry zone called Triangle. The name was derived from the shape of the site. The Žatec airport had been introduced into operation before the World War II, and some equipment and technologies, mainly underground tanks with jet fuels, dated from a war period, were used during the whole airport operation. And further enlargement of the airport took place after the war, especially in the 50s and in the 80s of the last century. The airport was closed down in 1992, but the army left all the airport premises in 1997. Contamination. During airport operation, petroleum hydrocarbons based substances were stored and used on its premises, which caused environmental pollution due to poor manipulation within delivery, distribution, use of oil substances. So the contaminations are mainly jet fuels, kerosene, oil, petrol, and in a small extent transmission and hydraulic oils. Former airport covers an area of 360 hectares. 1 hectare is approximately 2.5 acres. And contamination of unsaturated zone was found at 10 hectares and saturated zone at 30 hectares. To the picture, the long gray rectangle you can see in the picture right below is a former runway, 2.5 kilometers long, and it was used for on-site biodegradation of contaminated soil in the frame of remedial work. There is also a village, Nehasice, towards to the north of the airport area, where the contaminated ground flow has the same direction. So there was a serious threat of private wells by contamination. And some information concerning geological profile. In terms of remediation, the most important are quaternary sediments consisting of loess and loess loam in the upper part of the profile and gravel in the base. Moving to slide 32. Systematic remediation of the premises started in August 2003. Active operation of remedial technologies was terminated in 2008, and post-remedial monitoring is planned till the end of 2013. Remedial work were carried out in accordance with the administrative decision of the Czech Environmental Inspectorate, which states conditions for the remedial action, including the target limit for soil, this is important, 2000 milligrams of TPH total petroleum hydrocarbons per kilogram of dry matter, and for groundwater, removal of free phase of oil substances from the groundwater and maximum residual concentration less than 4 milligrams of dissolved hydrocarbons per liter. Following basic cleanup methods for remediation of the site were applied, bioremediation on site, in situ and ex situ, and pump and treat. Participating subjects, the owner and also the customer is the Ústí region. General contractor for the remedial project implementation was our company, Deconta, or is the supervising organization which monitors and checks quality and proficiency of work performed is the company Aquatest, and guarantee or sponsor is the Czech Investment and Development Agency. And the objective of remedial work was to eliminate contamination of soil and groundwater in the area of former airport as the first step prior erection of the new industrial zone. Moving to slide 33. activities on transforming this brownfield started in 2003 with designing the remedial project, obtaining necessary permits, site investigation, setting out of places to be cleaned up, and some preparatory work that had to be performed, such as pumping out of remaining petroleum products from the tanks, reconstruction of wastewater treatment plants and catch pits, etc. Last but not the least, disposal of hazardous substances which were found in the bunkers. For example, inflammable bottles, drums with chemicals. In 2004, large remediation started. Most of the work was focused on cleanup of soil in unsaturated zone. That's why excavation, earth moving, biodegradation on site, and then backfilling were performed. An integral part of the activities done was sampling and laboratory analysis. In the period 2005 to 2008, remediation of saturated zone was carried out, and there was applied bioregulation in situ, focus on remediation of the saturated zone and operation of hydraulic barrier, water treatment, and sampling. All these methods, all these mentioned works have been already completed. The only ongoing activity is the post-remedial monitoring. Moving to slide 34. Bioremediation on-site was chosen as the most suitable technology of treatment contaminated soil to decrease petroleum hydrocarbons content and to achieve the target limit. The main advantage is the elimination of huge transport of contaminated soil for outside disposal, landfill or incinerator. Contaminated soil was placed on a biodegradation platform. It was modified, a former runway, with a capacity of 200,000 tons of soil. Placed soil was separated in 20 sectors, divided by free space to collect the soil with similar character and content of contaminant, and the purpose for that was to do the most effective process of cleanup for each sector. Contaminated soil was placed on the platform so as its full aeration was ensured. Average pile height was 90 centimeters, and time needed for bioremediation processes was between 4 and 8 months, according to the contamination level and character of soil in each sector. On-site bioremediation included soil cultivation, application of bacteria preparation, and other additives. Biopreparation was produced or prepared in a biocenter installed at the site and transported and spread by tank truck. After laboratory proves that the target limits of TPH content was achieved, excavated areas were backfilled with the decontaminated soil. Backfilling of remedial excavation was performed by layers half a meter thick, and in total more than 180,000 tons of soil was decontaminated and backfilled. Carried out recalculation found that 411 tons of pure petroleum substances were removed during on-site soil remediation in total. Moving to slide 35. process of the on-site bioregulation was continuously controlled and optimized on the basis of laboratory results. On the graph, you can see degrees of TPH content in soil within each sector. Initial average TPH content ranged between 4 to 6,000 milligrams per kilogram, and reduction of petroleum hydrocarbons concentration below the target limit was reached after a maximum of 8 months at whole volume of contaminated soil. During monitoring and management of remedial work, thousands of samples for laboratory analysis were collected, and several model laboratory tests of bioregulation processes were performed as well, and then their results were applied on site in full scale. Within the framework of monitoring process, many data were monitored, not only TPH concentration, but also cyclophilic bacteria concentration, molecular weight of hydrocarbons, ecotoxicity, respiration intensity, concentration of mineral ions, pH, etc. Moving to slide 36. After excavation of contaminated soil from the unsaturated zone, remediation of the saturated zone underground body below the groundwater level was continuously carried out. In situ method was chosen in this case for two following reasons, except environmental benefits, which will be discussed later on. The first reason was legal and technical difficulty and high financial costs of contaminated soil excavation below the groundwater level. And the second reason was the fact that a significant volume of contaminated soil was also identified under the highway from Prague to Dresden, where excavation could not be performed. The technology of in situ remediation is in principle the same as the ex situ or on-site method, except the fact that bacteria suspensions and other additives are applied directly through infiltration drains into an underground body, and removal of soil is then not carries out. In the frame of preparatory work, biotechnological equipment was upgraded for permanent operation, and then the system for injection of biopreparation into the treated soil was installed. The infiltration drains were put down on the bottom of excavations, and the central delivery system for biopreparation distribution was installed. Moving to slide 37. Besides the remediation of contaminated soil, a massive contamination of groundwater had to be cleaned up as well. There was a free phase of petrol on the groundwater table and most of the wells at the beginning of the remediation. The highest TPH concentrations were found at the areas of former fuel bunkers and temporary hydraulic barrier operated in the past. TPH dissolved in the groundwater had maximum concentration up to 400 milligrams per liter, and average concentration was around 25 milligrams per liter. For the groundwater remediation, a combination of classic pump and treat system and biotechnology were applied. The hydraulic barrier consisted of 30 extraction wells situated in a line across the groundwater flow direction, and this barrier was operated to pump out contaminated groundwater and to eliminate further threatening of house wells situated around. Contaminated groundwater had been treated in three water treatment units installed also on the site. Three petroleum phase and sequentially dissolved contaminant were being removed using the system of gravity separator and absorption filter with fibroil in these units. Then treated groundwater was used for production and dilution of bacteria preparation, and finally infiltrated back to the aquifer. Thanks to this method, flushing of contaminated soils from the saturated zone was accelerated. Moving to slide 38, there were two main reasons for operation of the hydraulic barrier. The first reason was creation of a hydraulic depression and elimination of further migration of contamination. The second one was the cleanup of pollution from saturated zone. In the left graph, there is an average TPH content in pumped groundwater shown. The highest concentration were analyzed in 2007 and 2008, and these values correspond to the volume of oil product removed from the groundwater during this period. Remediation of saturated zone was finished successfully in 2009 when a rapid decrease of TPH concentration was recorded and no free oil product was removed. In total, 2,400 liters of three-phase petroleum hydrocarbons were removed from the groundwater table, and more than 11,000 kilograms of dissolved petroleum hydrocarbons were removed from the extracted groundwater. And the target limit for groundwater was achieved during 4 years operation at the entire area of 30 hectares. Moving to slide 39 with environmental benefits. With regard to sustainability, it has to be stressed that we didn't perform a sustainability assessment either during the design of the remediation nor during implementation. Hence, as Dekonta, since being established in 1992, is specialized in bioremediation of contaminated soil, our experiences show that about 50% projects referred to biological techniques, but within those projects up to 90% were ex situ and off-site, and 10% only in situ, and several projects were ex situ and on-site. Therefore, usual reference scenario on TPH contaminated sites in the Czech Republic would still be bioremediation off-site and average transport distances to treatment plants of 100 kilometers could be assumed. Comparing the baselines of such a reference scenario, a qualitative analysis of change practice, which are the on-site and in-situ approaches, as well as the reuse and recycling of the treated soil and groundwater, indicates clear advantages in terms of reducing energy consumption, reducing carbon dioxide emissions, reducing dust and noise disturbance, lowering risk of accidental release of contamination, minimizing water consumption, and minimizing waste production. Moving to slide 40, we minimize transport, which may be translated to energy savings and carbon dioxide savings like indicated on the slide. It is obvious that by working in close cycles, water consumption and waste production have been reduced even to a higher degree. Finally, such advantages also go hand in hand with benefits which are up to now even more interesting to site owners and investors, which are saving in terms of money and time. Moving to slide 41. Thanks to remediation of contaminated soil and groundwater, the former military airport was transformed into the industrial zone. It belongs to the largest one in the Central Europe. The site was awarded by the Czech government in category Brownfield of the Year. And nowadays, about one-third of the area is used by several industrial companies. Moving to slide 42. For example, Panasonic and Hitachi from Japan, solar turbines and GC interiors from the United States, Gestamp from Spain and others. Moving to slide 43. Finally, in particular, socio-economic aspects are of the highest importance within the three pillars of sustainability when remediation projects get real in transforming regions and economies like the Ústí region. And the SWOT analysis performed in 2008 confirmed overall positive aspects of the formation on the triangle zone. Clear economical as well as social benefits of this zone on the Ústí region were defined. Development of business, foreign trade, decrease of high unemployment rate, and hence of low education measures, etc. Moving to my last slide, slide 44, summary. As a summary to developing the triangle site, one may stress the aspects given. Designing a remediation project not only governs costs, but as well the environmental footprint. On-site and in-situ approaches may offer a lot of advantages in reducing wider environmental impacts while meeting defined remedial objectives and necessary risk reduction as well. There is still a gap, which means that consultants and contractors applicable sustainable analysis tools which are commonly accepted and suitable for practice. Finally, it's really important to assume socio-economic aspects in contaminated land management, and in particular, larger projects need local or regional involvement not only to get accepted but also to understand that remediation of the site may mean creating values in the terms of ecology as well as for regional communities. So I finish my presentation.
Thank you very much, Jan. I appreciate your taking the time to prepare and present. Let me first take a question on the internet, and then I'll see if there are any questions on the phone lines. There is a longer discussion question, which I'll hold for the end of the webinar, if that's okay. This specific question is from Carolyn Moore in CDM in San Francisco. The question is, during the investigation, did you encounter other contaminants that are typically associated with industrial activities at airfields, such as chlorinated solvents?
During investigation, we performed more than 150 boreholes and conduct a lot of chemical analysis, as well as we tested soil for chlorinated hydrocarbons. but it wasn't confirmed. So just petroleum hydrocarbons were identified, and according to this result or evaluation, bioremediation was proposed and finally applied on site.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the question and the answer. On the phone lines, any questions for Jan?
Hi, Carlos, it's Paul here. Paul here, I have a question. This is a question. I also put your question mark button. I'm interested to know from both speakers whether they used, what sustainability considerations played a part in the planning of their remediation designs and their projects. So both of the case studies have described possible environmental advantages, economic advantages, social advantages. What I'm interested to know is, are the speakers kind of giving benefit of information from their case studies, or was there some strategic approach to considering sustainability during the project design phases in California and in the Czech case study? Thank you.
So I couldn't hear it well, but I guess your question was concerning environmental benefits. So typical approach in the Czech Republic is at the beginning, after receiving results from initial investigation, to assess the feasibility study, and there is a list of potential remedial methods, and there is a calculation of the aspects of individual cleanup methods, and then it's continued by calculation and evaluation, and the best is chosen. So we did the same here.
Thank you, Andrew. Anything to add?
So in the case of the Apache Powder Superfund site, it was originally identified in 1990. The wetland system was constructed in 1997, and at that time, one of the major consultants on the project was very involved internationally, a professor on design of wetland systems in Gaza, in Africa, in Cuba, all over the world, for communities that had to be completely sustainable, that were, you know, did not have electricity available, et cetera. So, but it was definitely pre the linguistics, the language of sustainability, as applied to cleanup of Superfund sites. Post the wetlands being in place, post various solar systems being used at the site, consultants for EPA have helped me to convert the electrical savings to how many pounds of CO carbon dioxide equivalent emissions have been saved. So in the case of that 42 kilowatt solar canopy, it's offsetting 35,000 pounds a year of CO2. So it's been post the implementation that sort of the sustainability canopy or umbrella has been placed over the project. And I guess in many ways this was probably one of the very first Superfund sites in 1997, 98, 99 Several engineers that I work with just told me that this would never work, you know, my proposed remedy using the wetlands. And then even when I started using solar, but what moved us in that direction was the location, the lack of access to transmission lines. So I'd say we backed into the sustainability concept. But now we're repackaging all of our policy and thinking as to how to put it that in the front end versus capturing it at the back end, so to speak.
Great. Thank you, Andrea. And we do have some other questions, similar questions on the Internet, which I'll hold for hopefully we'll have some time at the end to follow up on some of those topics. So thank you, Paul, Andrea, and Jan. I'd like to hand it over now to Jarno Dubrow from the Environment Agency Austria. We're moving into a different area away from the case studies and more into the topic of resources, tools, and approaches to decision-making. So his presentation is on integrating sustainability into effectiveness assessment. So Jarno, thank you.
Good morning, or actually good evening from Austria. As it was mentioned, I'm going to present you Austria's new MCEA 2. MCEA means Modified Cost Effectiveness Analysis, and it is one of these tools. Jan had his last slide of the summary, one of these assessment tools which address ecology on the one hand and economy on the other hand. We implemented this tool to the recently, and it's actually to identify the best in terms of ecology and economy, the best remedial alternative. Coming to slide 46, how we got started, so why we in Austria implemented such a tool. We have a kind of similar funding system for remediation than the U.S., the Superfund system, and there are federal funding guidelines. If you apply for such kind of funding, you have to fulfill these guidelines, and these guidelines are claiming a maximum of ecological benefit under acceptable costs. To demonstrate this, you have to perform obligatory any kind of ecological economic assessment of your remediation alternatives. But neither the criteria nor the assessment tools have been standardized up to now. And in the first step, in the pre-project, if you like, so we screened the available economic ecological assessment methods, and we recommended to create their own assessment tool based on a so-called modified cost-effectiveness analysis. Then we started the project I'm going to talk about you, the modified cost-effectiveness analysis for remediation. The client was the Federal Ministry of Environment in Austria, and the contractors, the Environment Agency Austria, the Kommunalität Public Consulting, which is the bank who is actually responsible for the administration of the funding, and then there was a private consultant, Denkstadt. Coming to the next slide, 47, try to explain some of the reasons why we choose this modified cost-effectiveness analysis. On the one hand, it's a kind of established method, commonly used. It's quite simple compared to others, and it's kind of flexible. So cost-effectiveness analysis are a basis for many different other applications in different fields. And, of course, similar approaches have already been applied in studies on remedial alternatives, as I mentioned before. Another advantage is that there are quite clear definition of priorities is needed when applying this cost-effectiveness analysis. That means a so-called hierarchy of goals, different criteria and indicators, has to be established prior to apply this method. Another advantage is that driver cost ton.
It looks like there's an echo. Please try again.
The private costs keep as a separate parameter, for example, this is contrary to other multi-criteria analysis. And at least there is a high transparency. That means this method is not a black box like many other methods might be. Coming to slide 48, showing some principles of modified cost-effectiveness analysis. On the one hand, of course, there are costs, mostly private costs of the different remedial alternatives. On the other hand, there is the so-called effectiveness, which means kind of degree of achieving specific goals which have to be defined prior to the whole assessment. The result of a classical CEA is shown in the figure below. We have three alternatives, the corresponding costs, and the effectiveness in this case is measured with three criteria, 1 to 3, and that's it. That's the result of a classical CEA, which may be useful if one of these three alternatives is quite dominating the others. If this is not the case, it may become kind of tricky, and there are some principles how to overcome this problem. One of them is to modify the whole assessment methods. What we did, our modification is the aggregation of different effectiveness up to a total effectiveness, and to compare this total effectiveness of one alternative to the corresponding costs, in turn to get a kind of ratio between the effectiveness and the costs. So this is reflected by one single indicator, cost-effectiveness ratio, which is dangerous in terms of losing the whole picture. So what we would recommend is not only to rely on this single indicator, but to include this kind of matrix, which is shown in the figure, in the results as well. If you're interested in this method, there is some theoretical background in a paper we published about 10 years ago in Waste Management Research, and there will be a publication maybe this year, hopefully this year, from the Association of German Engineers on the guideline of assessment tools, including this modified cost effectiveness, which, to my knowledge, will be available also in English. Coming to slide 49, which showing the basis of each cost-effectiveness analysis, this system of goals, this hierarchy of goals I talked before. Hierarchy of goals means there is a level, there are level 1 goals, for example, which are mostly the main objectives we strive for. This is typically goal 1 could be, for example, typically the protection of man and the environment, the conservation of resources, and so on. So the main objectives of the whole thing. The problem is, of course, that to assess these goals is really tricky. So in practice, these goals are split up in different sub-goals, level 2 goals. Typically, for example, protection of air, protection of water, and so on. And again, this is split up in even more specific goals, like, for example, reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, and so on. At the lower most level, there are indicators or criteria which are measurable. So, for example, in kilograms CO2 per year, or similar things like this. And then, of course, you can weight the different goals. This is not obligatory, but mostly this weighting happens when applying such methods. The next slide, 50, since this hierarchy of goals serves as kind of basis for the whole assessment methods, one should pay attention to constructing this hierarchy of goals. In our case, we predefined some issues, like, for example, that the goals of the uppermost level, these overall objectives you saw before, and their weighting should be derived from national legislations, from guidelines or other international important documents. The goals of the lowermost level, this level of criteria also mentioned before, should be represented by criteria which is measurable, at least qualitatively measurable. Then the hierarchy of goals and the corresponding weighting should be defined in a consensus-based process, discussion process, ideally including the most relevant stakeholders. And we decided to predefine the upper-level goals, including their weighting. Slide 51. When it comes to sustainability, our starting point was a mission statement on contaminated site management, which has been released 2 years ago, and consists of six principles contaminated site management should follow. One of these principles says that remediation measures shall be sustainable and increase the environmental status permanently. So it's a quite clear statement on the implementation of sustainability issues into the remediation of contaminated sites, but it's clear that, of course, we need indicators, we need criteria reflecting these principles of sustainability, and, of course, we need a kind of assessment method to address this. In our case, this is the modified cost-effectiveness analysis. Coming to slide 52, when we constructed this hierarchy of goals, we started a discussion process, included several inner circle meetings, so the project team, the funders, and the people from the ministry, and we organized two workshops with all relevant stakeholders, so we invited about 30 people, including people from authorities, from consultants, but also site owners, people representing real estate development, spatial planning, science, the most important ones. We decided to use the National Water Act, the mission statement I mentioned before, as well as national goals on environmental quality to derive the level one goals, so the overall objectives, but also international documents like, for example, the ones published by Surf UK. You most probably heard about this in prior webinars. At least we got three level one goals. On the one hand, ecology, then the local development, and lastly, project stability. Next slide is number 3. Gives you an overview at this first goal at level one, addressing ecological effects, which is consisting of primary ecological effect. It means, of course, the goal of remediation is striving for, and of secondary ecological effects, which mostly includes these classical LCA indicators like greenhouse gas emissions, energy demand, waste generation, and so on. Whereas the primary ecological effects are addressing the different ways to reach the goal of remediation. On the one hand, you can head for the source of pollution, or you can head for the receptor, for example, the groundwater. Another important thing is the remediation period, means the duration from the beginning of the remediation until the end. The primary ecological effects and the indicators, which are at level 4, which is not shown here, are assessed semi-quantitatively, whereas most of the ecological effects, since they're mostly linked to costs, to private costs, are assessed quantitatively. Next slide is 54, which gives you an overview on the goal 2 at level 1, the local development, consisting of 3 level 2 goals: site development, addressing public interests and private interests, the increase in property value, of course, a very important thing, which is one of the main driving forces for remediation. And lastly, the decrease of new land consumption, which is one of these national environmental goals in Austria and, of course, also in Europe. Slide 55 gives you an overview on the last of the goals at level 1, the project stability, which integrates, on the one hand, local impacts on neighborhood, or restrictions in the use of infrastructure, mostly during remediation measures, and on the other hand, safety and stability issues like worker safety issues, the experience with the specific remediation technologies, that means is it state of the art or is it just in under development, but also the economic and legal flexibility of the different remediation technologies. If you go to the next slide, 56, there is a small summary of considering sustainability in our case study, in our assessment methods. At least we addressed all 3 pillars of sustainability: environment, of course, by all the ecological criteria, by the primary and secondary ecological effects. Economy or economical issues are addressed by mostly the second goal, the local development, the increase in site value, but also by some of the stability issues. And lastly, society is addressed by the discussion process at its own, so by creating, by constructing this hierarchy of goals, and of course by impacts on regions, neighborhoods, and workers at the site when remediating the site. But of course there are a lot of predefined principles which are set by the funder, which is reflected by the weighting. There is a clear priority of ecology compared to the other 2 overall objectives, compared to project stability and local development. There is a clear priority of primary ecological effects compared to the secondary ecological effects. And just to pick out one of the big discussion points we had to face, does the increase in site value create any public benefits? I mean, it's quite clear. It's also clear when you come to the prior presentation given by Jan. Of course, there is a public benefit, but it's mostly reflected indirectly, for example, by creating of jobs. If the site is adapted to commercial use, again, as Jan showed in his presentation before. I think this is very clear, but it was kind of big discussion when we developed this hierarchy of goals. Next slide, 57, is just to give you a very rough overview on the algorithm used in modified cost effectiveness. Again, we have 3 alternatives. I'm not going to go in detail with this slide, but just to give an overview. Again, you have 3 alternatives, A, B, C. You have 3 different goals at level 1, which are split up to the right in level 2 goals, and these goals are weighted. And the effectiveness in this very simple case is measured by an absolute scale from 0 to 10 points. And the effectiveness is simply calculated by multiplying the weight and the effectiveness score. The single effectiveness are summed up to a total effectiveness, and this total effectiveness is set into relation to the cost, leading to an effectiveness cost ratio, which you can see in the lower part of the figure, and which, of course, results in your ranking. And coming to my last slide, 58, this is just the output of the whole thing. We created a manual, which unfortunately is only available in German, and we created a software tool where these algorithms and also the hierarchy of goals is integrated. As I said before, this MCEA has been implemented at the beginning of this year, and it's now it's obligatory to use for studies on remedial alternatives if you apply for national funding. So that's the end of my presentation. Thanks for your attention.
Great, thank you very much, Jernak. Any quick questions on clarifications?
Extreme.
Please remember to put your phones on mute. We're hearing a conversation back there. I'm guessing it's not a question. Well, thank you very much. And in order to stay on time, I'm going to move on to my material. And we do have some questions pending on the internet. So thank you for those of you who submitted and appreciate your patience. I do hope to be able to get to them. Let me go through my material. So we should be on slide 59. So again, I am Carlos Pichon with the U.S. Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. I'm going to cover EPA greener cleanup developments, two in particular. The first is the release of the methodology for understanding and reducing a project's environmental footprint. And the second one is not something where we are in the driver's seat, but it's something we are participating in, and that is the ASTM standard practice for the development of that practice. Please make sure that your phones are on mute. There's a conversation coming through. Thank you. So let's go to slide number 60, please. On March 1st of this this week, actually, or late last week, if you subscribe to TechDirect, you received the notice that we had released the methodology, which we have been working on for almost coming up to 3 years now. There was a draft released back in November, and we got some extensive comments, which we incorporated into this final document. It's built around the five core elements of greener cleanups as identified in OSWER, that's the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response here in EPA, the principles for greener cleanups. An important note to make is that the remedy selection process remains the same in all cleanup programs. This methodology can be used in any of EPA's cleanup programs. However, unlike the previous presentation where there's an overall new approach to selecting a cleanup remedy, in this case, we're looking at evaluating the footprints of remedies but within the existing remedy selection process in all cleanup programs. So those have not changed. The remedy selection process remains the same in all cleanup programs. The footprint evaluation that's discussed in this technical document, it's not required. But if it is conducted, this is the preferred approach in EPA cleanup programs. Slide 61, please. So the methodology provides common footprint metrics and an approach. Excuse me a second here. An approach on and a process to quantify them. Additionally, it's designed to be compatible with existing footprinting tools. We looked primarily at the major ones that are available in the United States and on the market, such as the Sustainable Remediation Tool or SiteWise, when we were developing the methodology. So again, the methodology is mainly a protocol for evaluating footprints. It is not a tool in itself. There's really no software associated with it. It's more of a roadmap. Our intent was to write it in a way that any tool out there, from home-built spreadsheets to existing commercial tools, could work as well. We are running some pilots to check and see challenges, but that's the intent in designing it. It's based on lessons learned from multiple projects for printing exercises, where we did a quote-unquote 100% footprint analysis to help us shake out what common elements are typically significant contributors to a footprint, so we don't spend a lot of time chasing down insignificant footprint contributors. All of this experience was written up into the methodology. As we see it, the goal of an assessment, therefore, is to identify the most significant contributors for projects' environmental footprint and better focus efforts to reduce it. And one of the, I think, the more value added of the methodology is that it includes a lot of common conversion factors, contents of materials frequently used in cleanup, typical energy demands of equipment deployed in the field, et cetera. So it has quite a few reference tables, and it provides a source for the information. So our experience was that a lot of time can be spent tracking down this information, which was previously not readily available, and we provided it for distribution with the methodology. Slide 68, please. So based on our experience, again, on those approximately 19 full footprinting studies we did, the cost of analysis, a footprint analysis, ranges from $5,000 to $15,000. So while it's not insignificant, it is a relatively small cost compared to the, you know, the cost of a major remediation projects. For small projects, maybe brownfield cleanups, underground storage tanks, pools, et cetera, that are either less expensive or simpler or both, our recommendation would be go straight to green remediation fact sheets for the most common cleanup approaches, where we've already pulled together a list of what best management practices may be applicable to that remedy. We're not suggesting that this footprint evaluation is necessary at every project. That's certainly not the case. Naturally, there is a lower cost to the footprint and to the greening of a remedy if it's done concurrent with other design, other planning or design activities. And as I just mentioned, it's less expensive to build footprint reduction measures into a remedy than to have to retrofit an existing remedy that's already in the field. Okay, slide 63, please. A couple of clarifications on the methodology and its applicability. A question that we've heard quite often is, does the methodology call for life cycle assessment? And the answer is no, it does not. It may be considered life cycle assessment like. A lot of information collected would be required as part of life cycle assessment. But the purpose is it calculates green remediation metrics, but it does not apply what's known as an impact assessment, as is typically required in a full life cycle assessment. A lot of the materials in waste target on-site use and generation rather than off-site, so there's difference in boundaries there between the footprinting methodology and a life cycle assessment. And energy emissions and water also have fairly broad system boundaries. So that is another area where there are significant differences. From what you heard earlier, in a lot of sustainability evaluation, we look at three parameters, environmental, social, and economic. The question is, does this methodology consider social and economic factors? And the fact is the methodology focuses on the environmental footprint. And made this decision because social and economic factors are addressed in EPA cleanup programs through existing processes such as community involvement requirements and EPA's redevelopment initiative, among others. So those aspects of the social and economic implications of a remedy are already factored into existing remedy decision processes. So what we looked to do was to work sustainability back into existing protocols for remedy selection. So slide number 64, please. This a quick snapshot of what green remediation metrics, I guess you could call them environmental metrics, we arrived to. These are the ones that we figured were the most commonly occurring, most easily manageable, or metrics where we could actually have an impact in the way we design, build, and operate a remedy. And they are simplified. There is an expanded table for all of these in the methodology. But basically, for energy, it's total energy used and total energy voluntarily derived from renewable resources. For air, it's greenhouse gases, and then criteria pollutants, NOx, SOx, and particulate matter, both on-site emissions and total emissions. Hazardous air pollutants, again, on-site emissions and total emissions. And then for water, we have on-site water use, including public potable water, and there are parameters associated with the quantity of water, the source of water, and the fate of used and treated water. And these intend to account for variations in value and scarcity of water. For example, the case that we saw earlier of Arizona situation is quite different in how water is valued than, for example, would be the case in the Pacific Northwest. So the methodology provides that flexibility to adjust as needed. Slide number 65, the final metric fully developed here is materials and waste, where we looked at refined materials used on site, including manufactured goods, and the quantity and percent of those that are derived from recycled sources. The bulk of unrefined materials used on site, and again, percentage of those that are recycled. And then with respect to waste, we look at three sub-parameters: hazardous waste generated on site, non-hazardous waste generated on site, and the percent of the total potential waste generated that is recycled or reused. The last and fifth of the core elements is the land and ecosystems. And currently, we opted to move forward, including only a qualitative evaluation of land and ecosystem metrics, because there is so much work going on currently within the agency, outside the agency, et cetera, with respect to ecosystem services evaluation, challenges with the scale challenges, for example. What impact can one cleanup have on ecosystem scale parameters? So we are continuing to look at that, and in the next iteration, we do hope to provide some further clarification on what considerations or what actions can be taken to reduce, to mitigate impacts on existing ecosystem services available at cleanup projects. So with that, move on to 66, please. Where will the methodology be used? Again, for all types of cleanup projects, both in scale and type of remedy. In the United States, it can be used in any and all cleanup programs. This is not Superfund specific, for example, and certainly throughout the various phases of a cleanup. There are many existing systems out there that have a long operating period, and they're periodically revisited. At that point, it would make sense to apply the methodology and see what can be done to reduce the remedy's footprint. But we look at it earlier on, because that's when we can more effectively manage how the system is designed and operated. How will we use the methodology in EPA? We'll be training our technical staff on ways to understand and reduce the footprint. So we do expect to do a lot of in-house training. We will conduct footprint analyses at our own sites when we're appropriate. And this is me speaking from the Superfund program where I work, but we are collaborating, of course, with other cleanup programs. We will use this to standardize environmental footprint analyses, which was one of the main goals of doing this, of providing a standard series of metrics and protocol for doing environmental footprint. And we'll use this template to facilitate the evaluation of environmental footprint analyses submitted by outside parties. So slide 67, this is a reminder that we will be having a broader webinar on the environmental footprint evaluation methodology April 18th. You can register at that URL. It is open to the public. So we look forward to having you participate there. We'll go into more depth on how the values have arrived, et cetera, and hopefully have a bit more of a discussion. So on slide 68, this is another topic I wanted to update you on, the ASTM standard practice for greener cleanups, which is in the draft form. As I mentioned earlier, ASTM is an independent standards development and setting organization. They are the lead on this effort, and while EPA is participating, this is not a quote-unquote EPA product or effort. It was initiated in 2008 with a cross-sector work group participating in the development of the standard. Currently, what we're looking at focuses on evaluating and implementing activities to reduce the environmental footprint of a cleanup project. So, again, it does look to work within existing remedy selection protocols. It provides a process to identify and implement approaches to reduce the environmental footprint of a cleanup through a combination of best management practices and a quantitative evaluation. Slide number 69, second slide on the ASTM standard practice. It is a voluntary standard practice that does include a robust documentation process. That's one area that we're particularly vocal on, that we thought it was going to be voluntary. It's got to be very clear of how decisions were made and what actions were taken and what results were obtained from that action. So we believe that it's in the draft form, it currently has a robust documentation process. Currently, the draft form is in what's called balloting, with a final anticipated in approximately 1 year. That's what I was told when asked what timeline I could provide. Here's some couple of links for more information on the ASTM website, which is rather short, I should say, or you can contact this person, John Simon, who is the task group leader for development of the standard practice. And with that, I hand it over to, I think a couple of questions came in, but I'd like to save some time for those at the end. So I'll hand it over to Paul Bartos, who's going to provide us updates on international initiatives. Paul, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. I can't remember what's... Oh, yes. Sorry, everybody. I'd like you to start on slide 70. What we have been doing over these webinars is asking the different initiatives going on about sustainable remediation across the world if they would like to send us an update for the webinar, and then I basically give their slides. So any mistakes that are made about these initiatives, I apologize in advance, they're all mine. I'd like to move to slide 71. I'll begin with the Common Forum. For those of you who are not aware of what the Common Forum is, it's a network of regulators and policy people working at a national level in what's called the EU 27. That's the 27 member states of the European Union. The Common Forum, along with some European projects, is instrumental in developing a consistent approach to risk-based land across Europe. And it's now working to develop this really as a fourth generation policy concept that they're calling risk-informed and sustainable land management. They're working on a discussion paper within the network, and they're hoping to release that after some discussions by the end of the year. We hope in time for the Sustainable Remediation Conference in Vienna in November 2012, And a number of these European initiatives, like NICOL, SURF UK, and the Common Forum, are collaborating to try and put forward a joint paper on sustainable remediation, to try and identify a consensus on common principles and perhaps a common technical base. We move to the next slide, slide 72. NICOL is a network for industrially contaminated land in Europe. It's a sister network to the Common Forum, and NICOL's membership is drawn mainly from problem holders, if you like, and the service providers who try and assist them. NICOL has had a working group focused on developing concepts of sustainable remediation for several years and recently published what it calls a roadmap to finding sustainable remediation. Currently, NICOL is looking to find some case studies and examples of projects where sustainable remediation has been documented. And again, this idea of a joint statement with other European networks is mentioned. And NICOL will be supporting the conference, which Dietmar is about to tell you about in the next paper. So if we move to slide 73. I guess the Sustainable Remediation Forum is the granddaddy of many of these initiatives now. This was, or has been, a network initiated by service providers and by industry and research community. And SURF used sustainable remediation as a holistic approach that incorporates all three elements of sustainability: environmental, social, and economic. And it regards the environmental aspect as important. That's just one component of sustainable remediation. There are several new technical initiatives underway in SURF. What I should say, by the way, is that all of these slides are updates. So if you go back to the original resource link that I'm sure Carlos will remind you of for all of these webinars, you'll see several presentations from these networks, and this will show you how, if you like, the state of the art has been developing worldwide and developing quite quickly. Anyway, back to SURF's technical initiatives. The first of these is a sustainable remediation and redevelopment discussion document, which plans to be released in draft in May 2012. The recent meetings of SURF include SURF 19, which was called Share the Vision Towards a Sustainable Future, which was hosted by the University of California, San Diego, at the end of January this year. There were several panel discussions, which included representatives from the Regional Water Quality Control Board, City of Chula Vista, which I hope I haven't pronounced wrongly, the Institute for Sustainable Infrastructure, American Society of Landscape Architects, representatives of the Port of San Diego, San Diego Airport. And there's information and feedback on all of these meetings on the SURF website. The next meeting, SURF 20, will be held in July this year, and there'll be a further meeting in December. Finally, SURF wants to emphasize that it continues its education research mission by fostering the development of student chapters of SURF, and it's begun competitions for student inputs to the SURF meetings. So, next slide, which is slide 74. Well, SURF Australia is now SURF Australia and New Zealand. So I guess it's SURF ANZ. And this initiative is going to continue with support from a group called ALGA in Australia. ALGA is a trade organization for people involved in land and groundwater cleanup. Peter Nadebaum, who's one of the initiators of SURF Australia, has represented at several meetings, and his view is that there are a lot of projects already going on in Australia that would fit in with outcomes that are consistent with the application of principles of sustainability. And he puts that down to the inherent flexibility of the Australian regulatory system. Something that he emphasises is very important is that risk is a key aspect, and it's important that decision making should be focused both on the principles of sustainability and of risk management. And this is entirely consistent with the view that the UK has taken. Now, SURF is represented also in the steering group of a large nationally funded project at the Australian Research Institution called CRC Care, which is trying to develop a national framework for remediation, well, succeeding, I would guess, which includes a broadly based group of industry and regulators. It's expected that this national framework is going to include references to the principles of sustainability. Final few notes from Peter is that they now have a new chairman for SURF Australia, Gary Smith of AECOM, and the planning is underway for a broadly based SURF ANZ meeting in March, i.e. in the next few days. So we could move on now to slide 75. The SURF Netherlands is a new arrival, and it has already got quite a large number of participants, and it's a cross-sectoral organization across problem holders, regulators, planners, and service providers. And its vision is broader than just remediation. It's looking also at soil protection and, in general, sustainable management of soil and groundwater quality. And its goal is to look at this entire soil management sector and facilitate a transition to a transparent and integrated way of working, which is based on sustainability principles and fits in with spatial planning practice in the Netherlands. They have launched a position paper, and they are developing their business plan for this current year. We move on now to the next slide, which is slide 76, SURF in the UK. They've all been inspired by the granddaddy SURF in America, and they share the name, and they work with each other, but just for point of clarity, they're all independent initiatives. So SURF UK has started producing some supporting guidance for the framework on sustainable remediation that it produced in 2010, including some suggestions for categories of indicators that might be important to consider in sustainable remediation. This work to date in SURF UK has more than 270 consultation and participation inputs from industry, public sector, consultants, regulators. It's a very broadly based initiative. The project's hoping to start a phase three from next month. In common with Nicole, it has an interest in developing case studies and also in improving and refining the guidance that it's made available and providing some training support with a webinar. And all of this work will be developed with industry regulators and other stakeholders through a series of workshops and an open consultation process. And I think that's it from me now. I've tried to go as quickly as I could, so I'm sorry if it's got a bit garbled. If you have any questions, then drop a line to Carlos and he can forward them to the initiatives concerned. And with that, Carlos, I hand over to you.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you for compressing it. I appreciate it. We are obviously very almost out of time. What I'd like to do is provide DMARV an opportunity to present what's going to happen in Vienna in fall, and then I'm going to add 10 minutes to the presentation to address those questions that are there. So I'm sorry if you have to leave noon sharp, but I would like to address some of those questions so the speakers can hang on. I appreciate it. So, Dietmar?
Thanks, Carlos. Hi again from Vienna. So the last part of the webinar before the discussion is simply to have an announcement for, if you go to slide 77, we are about organizing a second international conference on sustainable remediation to be held in Vienna by November this year. You see the web direction you may follow to find information on the conference. It's a follow-up event for the green remediation event in Copenhagen 2009 prior to the World Summit, Climate Summit. If you move to slide 78, you get an overview for the conference theme, so we are looking broad, so starting from policy and conceptual frameworks, but nevertheless also going for the metrics, practical tools, case studies, and so on. The call for abstracts for the conference will be launched these days. Moving to slide 79, you see the program overview. So we will have a 2.5 days conference starting on the afternoon on Wednesday, November 14th, with having a plenary sessions and maybe also, depending on the abstracts coming in, some parallel sessions. Thursday is a whole day which will be held in technically parallel sessions and project workshops, so we also expect several science projects, European ones, to the conference. And finally, on Friday, we will have the, again, coming together in a plenary session, holding a poster session, having to sum up a roundtable discussion at the final end. On slide 80, you see the key dates. So by end of April, we will have the abstracts in. And further, we will announce the final program by end of August. I also want to point you to the next and final internet seminar before the conference, which is scheduled for September 19th. More information will follow. And then, hopefully, by end of the year, by November, to see you at the Sustainable Remediation Conference. Slide 81 is simply to say what we're aiming at. We just want to create a meeting place. We are teamed up now. You see all the partner organizations, starting from US EPA, the Common Forum, NICOL. We're also involving the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and still to be confirmed, further partners from Latin America and Australia. Regional organizers, the Environment Agency Austria and the University of Natural Resources and Life Sciences here on. And with that, Carlos, I hand back to you.
Great. Thank you, Dietmar. I'm sorry you had to rush through it. I'd like to get at least to some of these questions. I'm not sure how much of a discussion we will have. And to be respectful of everybody's time on completing the questions, we'll close out the webinar. Let me just start here with some questions for Jana regarding, no, I'm sorry, yes, that's right, regarding the MCEA tool. Two questions, one from Madrid, from David San Juan with ERM and San Julian, I'm sorry, and the other from Rick Burden at Minnesota. The question is, will the tool be translated into English?
Hmm.
Dietmar, or Jarno, are you there for that question?
Yeah. This is Gernot again from Austria. Originally, it's of course not planned to translate it in English, but I think there will be a presentation at the conference Dietmar mentioned, so there will be material available in English as well. But I'm not sure if it's the whole handbook we created.
So you do not expect that the handbook will be translated to English, is that correct?
The whole handbook not, but of course there will be some material available in English.
Great. Thank you.
Due to publications and conference presentations and so on.
Perfect. Andrea, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
A question from Nick Carson from Boeing Seattle. Nick, nice to hear from you again. The question is, was GSR and alternative energy part of the remedy selection process or part of an optimization strategy once the remedies were evaluated and approved by EPA? I think you partially answered this question, but is there anything to add?
The record of decision, the original record of decision, and the feasibility study was completed in 1994. So, no, in today's language, today's verbiage that we use for describing sustainability or optimization, it was not specifically in those documents, although the feasibility study did talk about costs, you know, the 9 criteria that are used by EPA for our Superfund feasibility study. It went through those. So the answer is no, not at the time of the original decisions.
Okay, thank you. And I guess a question was powering it with solar energy that was funded by the party, by the owner of the site. Did that require any administrative action on the part on behalf of the agency?
The actual renewable energy evaluation was actually conducted by EPA's Superfund Reuse Revitalization Program. This site has had construction complete for a term that we use for when the actual construction phase of the remedy has been completed. The wetlands were completed, the capping and of any residual soils was completed, and at that point it was eligible for reuse revitalization funding. So the renewable energy evaluation, I didn't go into that second tier of detail, but it was done by an EPA contractor.
Okay, thank you. A couple of technical questions related to the presentations. One from Ursula Gardner, Red Rock Geoscience in the UK. This is for Jan, I believe. In the case of Triangle Xanthic site, how high were the soil concentrations of TPH and for the soils excavated and cultivated? Was there any odor issue that could pose a risk to workers or nearby residents? And how did you deal with those? Are you there, Jan?
Yes, I'm here. With the residents, so the initial concentration in the soil ranged between 4 and 12,000 milligrams of per kilogram of TPH. And the target limit was set up by the Czech inspector, environmental inspectorate, as the responsible authority. And the target limits were set up according to risk analysis, which was elaborated before. And it was approved, and that's all.
Okay, thank you. Let me see any questions on the phone lines. Okay, I did get a request from Paul to remind people of the URL where we have posted all this information and information from previous webinars and conferences and where we'll be tracking what happens in Vienna. It's CLUIN.org. So it's kluin.org/global. Okay. Again, any questions on the phone lines? Okay, I do have a question here. It doesn't have an author. The question is, have we looked at how environmental footprint analyses compare under different environmental conditions? For example, remediation project in a remote area, for example, subarctic and arctic area, versus a project in an urban location. And yes, certainly that's exactly what the methodology does, is provides that roadmap to accounting for different core elements depending on the location. So it is factored in there. It doesn't specifically say if you are in this type of location, but if one applies the methodology, those types of conditions like long transportation of resources, et cetera, will play out. So I think that's it. Let me ask the other speakers if they have anything they would like to add at this point. Or for those of you on the phone lines, any additional questions? Okay, there are some more specific questions that are very focused and targeted to individual speakers, including myself. I'll provide those to make sure the speakers get those and can reply to you to those questions by email. But with that, Dietmar, anything else you would like to say?
No, I just think we will have more information out soon and, forwarded through the different networks on the Vienna conference. Thanks, Carlos.
Yeah, certainly. And then just one more thing. We have tentatively scheduled a webinar prior to the Vienna conference. It'll probably, I think it's going to be in September, if I recall right. So expect an announcement on that soon. Did you happen to have the exact date, Dietmar or Carolyn? Do you have the date with you?
It was September 19th.
September 19th, thank you. So if you ever would like to pencil that in, that'll be precursor to Vienna and a follow-up to this series of webinars. So with that, thank you very much to the speakers and to all the participants. We had a great turnout, almost 240 people, so we're very happy for that, and we appreciate your time and participation. Goodbye, everybody.